I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's a new novel out this week called The Cannibal Spirit. Its author, Harry Whitehead, joins me now. He worked for many years in the film business and has degrees in creative writing and medical anthropology and a PhD from Lancaster University. He teaches at the University of Leicester. He's in town this week speaking at the Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival. There's an event Wednesday the 19th at 8 p.m. Check out their website at writersfest.bc.ca for more information and tickets. George Hunt, who was an assistant to the famed anthropologist Frantz Boas, is the central figure in this fictionalized account, which looks at native traditions, anthropology, spirituality, and the chasm between two civilizations in these parts at the turn of the last century. We'll get Harry Whitehead to tell us about this book, how he came to write it, and more. The book is published by Hamish Hamilton, which is an imprint of Penguin. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Harry Whitehead. Good morning, Dr. Whitehead.
Hello. How are you, Joe?
Very good. Yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Someone asked me the other day when I was talking to them about you and this book, your background in medical anthropology, and they asked me what that was, and I couldn't really explain it, so I guess I should ask someone who studied it. Well, what is that exactly?
Well, it looks very broadly at cross-cultural perspectives on health, both mental and physical health, so different systems of healing around the world, how they're understood, how they're practiced.
And what, I guess, in your case, what inspired you or what brought you to study that?
Well, I had read, when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I had read a story about a rather obscure 19th century shaman from British Columbia who had decided to become a shaman in order to expose the lies and trickery of shamanism. Now, he goes off and he learns all these various arts of prestidigitation and what have you, and then his chieftain has a dream that only he can heal his sick son. Very reluctantly, the shaman performs these rituals he doesn't believe in, and of course, lo and behold, the child is cured. Now, this story kind of obsessed and fascinated me and led me to go on and do this master's degree in order really to track down who the character was and to kind of understand a little better what it meant, what performance healing means, how it works, what the story is.
And so is the guy George Hunt in this book?
He is, yes. In 1997, I got a few hundred quid from my university and came out here to track down his true identity. And at UBC and at the Royal British Columbia Museum archives, I discovered that he was this guy, George Hunt, whose father, in actual fact, was white and a Hudson's Bay Company factor, and whose mother was a Tlingit noblewoman out of Alaska, but who grew up among the Kwakiutl people at the northern end of Vancouver Island. So, of course, he was even more fascinating to discover as a true character because he existed very much in this liminal space between worlds, and he wasn't quite this original shamanic guy that I'd imagined he would be.
Yeah, so what in the book is real, and what have you taken sort of literary liberty with?
Well, the book centers around his trial on charges of cannibalism in 1900, and I've kept the structure of that trial pretty accurately. And then what I've done is I've kind of concatenated a whole series of other events from his life and sort of drawn them into this 1 6-week period where many of them, for instance, his son's death, which happens at the beginning of the book, happened, in fact, 25 years later in his life. But his emotional response to it is kind of, I hope, reasonably accurately reflected. But it's very much, I think the phrase based on a true story is probably an accurate way to put it, in that I've felt reasonably free to step on and make up what I felt I needed to do.
And you mean you're an academic? Why go the novel route rather than something, something nonfiction?
Well, I was and I wasn't an academic. I am now, but once I'd finished my master's degree, I took off and ended up working in the film business for about 12 years. And I've come back into academia by doing a part-time PhD for some years on the side and writing my novel. But I tried to write it as a biography, but I increasingly came to realize that really my interest in the subject was about my own obsessions. I'd broke my back when I was 25, and I had a couple of years learning to walk again, and, you know, that was around the time I first read about this shamanic character, and so George Hunt's life was very much being played out in my mind through a kind of a series of my own obsessions with him. And I just couldn't bring the biography to life as much as I tried and tried again. And in the end, it was a movie script for a while and a theater play and all kinds of things. And then eventually, it sort of coalesced into the novel that it is, and that just felt the truest way that I could express the story I had to tell.
So what sort of person was Hunt? Was he able to bridge the gap between sort of his being native and being white at the same time?
Well, he was a tough guy, you know, and he lived in tough times, and he grew up kind of, you know, he grew up with his father as the boss of the local fort, so a man of some influence, and his mother, this noble woman from another tribal group that had been on and off at war for 300 years with the people among whom he grew up. And when at 18 he married into these people, through the marriage and through his mother's line, he actually ended those hundreds of years of warfare. So he became quite a central figure to the people. But he was liked and loathed almost in equal measure, both by the people themselves and also by the white colonial population at the time, who saw, you know, because he was writing about the native people's culture, it was, you know, it was going against the dominant ideology of the whites at the time, which was to try and suppress that culture. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had a pretty tough time of it. He was, you know, put upon partly by his own people, if you like, and partly by the white population. I think that created, there was a lot of rage in him. He was prone to these kind of rages and furies that everybody was rather afraid of, because he was a huge man. And I think that those rages kind of reflected that inability on his part ever to really feel at home in one world or the other.
So how did he and Boas meet? And for people that don't know who Franz Boas is, he's pretty important in sort of the field of anthropology, right?
That's right. Well, he founded American anthropology, pretty much, and he was one of the great fighters in the battle against scientific racism at the end of the 19th century in America. So he was a pretty noble guy one way or another. But Boas came to British Columbia to do some ethnography, some research among the people in 1888, I think it was. And he was sniffing around looking for a guide and a translator in Victoria. And a friend of his, Newcomb, said, "Oh, I know this guy, George Hunt, who'd done a little bit of translating for somebody else." And they had what was not a promising meeting. They met in some DOS house in Victoria, and I think Hunt was about 4 hours late and was kind of thinking about other things and was quite dismissive of him. So it was all quite unpromising. But then they met sometime later up in the north end of Vancouver Island, and Boas realized actually what a very clever and diligent man he was. And he was also a rare thing. He could read and write and speak about five of the different languages of the coast as well. So he was quite a unique guy.
And so their working relationship was pretty good, was it?
It was good. Yeah, no, there's very little. I mean, I think over 40 years, there's only two or three letters that I've ever discovered from Boas where he kind of moans about Hunt kind of not doing something he was supposed to. But otherwise, he seems to speak with great respect of Hunt, and Hunt had enormous respect for Boas. His letters are always so, so polite to Boas whenever he wrote to them. There are you know, decades of correspondence still existing between them.
And Hunt, he wrote himself, did he?
Like, well, he did, and what Boas created and Hunt helped him do was he created a written language for Kwakwala, which was the language of the people, is the language of the people, and was the first person to do that. And it was a very unwieldy, complex written form, but he taught it to George Hunt. And Hunt would go out and get all these stories and histories and write them in Kwa Kwala and then write in English underneath. And he'd send kind of 50, 60 pages of this very difficult to read scrawl to Boaz every few months. And that went on for years and years. There's some 5,000 pages or more of it.
Now, in reading up on you and in this book, there's comparison to Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Were you inspired by that book, and what's the comparison like?
Well, you know, it's funny because I hadn't actually read Heart of Darkness until after I'd finished the second draft of the book, and several people said to me, well, you know, it's Heart of Darkness in Canada, isn't it, Harry? I said, no, but... And I'm sure I was informed by it, and I'd seen Apocalypse Now, like everybody else, many times. But it was actually two books that really did inspire me were Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy and Little Big Man by Thomas Berger. I think they probably were the two that influenced me most. And then when I was here in Canada the first time, after I discovered who Hunt was, and I put my thumb out and hitched my way north to the top of the island and walked along the shingle beaches, and then I'd set off for a walk into the forest and predictably enough got hopelessly completely lost within about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And was sort of trying to struggle my way through the thick undergrowth and came upon this trail. I thought, oh, thank God, I'll follow this trail. But it was quite low, it was only about 4 feet high, and I stumbled along this trail for several minutes and then walked into this larger space that stank of animal. And I, just as I was standing there like a cockney twit, and realized the penny dropped and I'd followed a bear trail all the way into a bear den.
Yeah.
So I beat my way out through the undergrowth and found I was only about 15 meters from the beach,
wow,
as it turned out. But that kind of, that life experience kind of stuck with me one way and another, and I took it and all my knowledge of Hunt's life back with me to London, and I think I was informed by, you know, that kind of experience, the forest, and, you know, kind of all kinds of different influences, I guess.
How much time did you actually spend out here?
About 3 months, I think it was.
Yeah, and going back to those places up north there on the island, has it changed a great deal in the last 100 years or so?
Well, I haven't been back yet. I've landed yesterday.
Yeah.
But I sure hope I do, but I haven't as yet.
Yeah, when you were there before?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, it had, absolutely. And I had, you know, constructed all kinds of fantasies about how I understood the space to be through my readings. But I wasn't hugely experienced then. I hadn't read an awful lot. You know, it was whilst I was here last time that I was really taking on board all that knowledge. So partly it was informed by my experiences of being there, and particularly the Umista Cultural Center on Alert Bay, which is a really magnificent place, and everybody should go there at some point. It's beautiful. And the material culture there and the art was quite a profound influence on me at the time.
So through this book, we get a sense of sort of native spirituality and how it was perceived in these parts by whites.
Mm.
Do you come to any conclusions on how to explain the relationship
Between the whites and the people, people.
Yeah, and how whites at the time viewed.
Well, there were a couple of decisions I made about the book. One was not to be didactic in any way, just to tell my story.
Mm-hmm.
And two was that I didn't really see any antagonist, any enemy as such. And I tried to show how the white people at the time, you know, my kind of what you might call the bad guy of the piece, William Halliday, the Indian agent, he genuinely believes that the only hope for the people is to turn to Christianity and to accept the modern world and to reposition themselves into the modern world if they have any chance of survival. And, you know, there's been this whole thing about the vanished people, and, you know, many of these vanished people say, hey, you know, we're not vanished at all, here we are. But this was the dominant ideology of the time among the white population, was that of, you know, kind of helping rather than any sort of malicious intent as such. Of course, we see it now for the kind of more subtle racism and colonialist behavior that it actually was. But it wasn't always couched in malicious intent. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so there was this piece in The Walrus. Have you read that?
I have. Yeah. Here's the piece, yeah.
I don't read fiction very much, and so, you know, I don't really know much about what's been written previously. Mm. And so in the piece, it talks about it talks about your book. It also talks about sort of cannibalism as part of Canadian literature.
Mm.
That's sort of an unknown about sort of the writing in this country, right?
Mm.
I mean, the piece writes that Atwood and Richler had written about it.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And I certainly wasn't consciously trying to position myself in a Canadian literature tradition particularly. And indeed, you know, I hadn't really, you know, imagined that I was writing a book particularly about Canada, that Canada was its subject matter. What really interested me was this liminal space, this space in between worlds that Hunt existed in, and his inability to kind of build a meaningful narrative for himself about who he was. So every time he'd say to himself, you know, okay, I'm Kwaki Utlu and I'm going to stand up for the people, and, you know, against the oppression that's going on upon them, he'd be flipped upside down and they'd turn against him and he'd have to reposition himself as a white man. And then he'd do that, and then he wasn't accepted by the white population. The missionaries pretty much set him up for this trial. So the fact that he just, even though he was desperate to find some kind of firm identity for himself, and he lived in this sort of Victorian scientific kind of era that tried to make sense of everything, he could never do it. And that was really what spurred me on and what I was most fascinated about in this character and what led me to write the book.
Are there sort of nonfiction books about Hunt?
No, there are a number of shorter articles. No one's written a full-length book about him. There's sort of four or five academics, I guess I could name, who've written sort of shorter and longer essays on him, and I've written a few. But no one's yet written a biography about him, no.
It's just a fascinating sort of entry point into him and sort of this part of the world at that time. Mm. What's next for you, Harry?
Well, I did sign a two-book deal with Penguin, and that's coming up. Yeah. My deadline for my second book. I'm kind of midway between two ideas that I've been writing up that I'm uneasy about discussing the details of, simply because they're still coming together in my mind. But I think I hopefully should finish my second novel by the end of next year, I'm hoping.
Now, this book now, it's published in Canada, obviously. Is it published in your country?
Not yet, although I have a couple of publishers kind of lurking in the wings, I think, awaiting how it does in the first weeks out here now.
Yeah.
It's funny, it's almost partly as if, that, you know, the success of being published as well as has happened here has almost turned me into a Canadian author in my own country.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have to say, in all truth, having written the book, for it to have been picked up here is the bottom line for me. I mean, that just makes it worthwhile, really, that it's been accepted to the degree it has been so far.
Yeah, they send you these lists, of course, of authors that, you know, that are available for this week, and when I saw your name on there, I didn't know you, obviously, but I started reading about the book. I automatically just assumed that you were a Canadian author, you know, sort of Toronto or something like that.
Yeah.
So, the reception thus far, I mean, there's a piece in the Walrus. The book has been received quite well, hasn't it?
It has so far, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm being reviewed in the Post and maybe the Globe and Mail in the coming days, so we'll see whether the knives are being sharpened in the forest for me or otherwise. But so far, I've been received very kindly, and I had been, you know, I was actually quite full of trepidation as well as joy about this publication, about how, you know, you guys would take it, this limey coming over, kind of preaching about Canadian history. I wasn't too sure how I'd be received, of course.
Congratulations on this book, Eric. It's been delightful to talk to you today. Good luck with it.
You too, absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I can't wait to finish the book. The book is called The Cannibal Spirit. It's published by Hamish Hamilton. It's an imprint of Penguin. Its author, Harry Whitehead, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.